Hey, denk dran, dass auch dein Immunsystem Hunger hat. Und probier's mal mit den Gesundheitszielen zur Ernährung in der App Auka Navida. Hol dir Tipps, Rezepte und Challenges für dein gesünderes Ich. Jetzt die App Auka Navida downloaden und loslegen. Auka Plus. Aus Liebe zur Gesundheit.
The Axe of the Blood God.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Cat Bailey. With me, as always, my now alive, beautiful co-host, Nadia Oxford.
Thank you. I debate the beautiful part, but I am definitely alive after a bout with the flu. It tried to kill me, but I bested it.
Yeah, we had some bad luck in terms of actually recording this podcast because you were out with the flu, like just... We were going to do our Final Fantasy IX wrap-up before the year ended, but then you ended up being sick, and I ended up doing the best games of the year with Mike instead, which ended up working out okay, because he was able to talk at some length about Final Fantasy XIV Stormborn and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think you guys talked about Divinity Original Sin 2, didn't you?
Yes, which he played a whole bunch of, so he actually ended up reviewing and really enjoying, so. And then, of course... Bob wasn't able to make it on the podcast to talk about Monster Hunter World when they were doing the beta, which was unfortunate, but things work out. It's a new year. It's a new time to do things. It's another year of Axe of the Blood God. I think this is year 4 at this point.
That's a pretty
good... We started in 2015, so technically we're heading into the third year of this podcast's existence, but
wow, that's pretty impressive for a podcast. Sometimes people usually give up after like 3 episodes.
Yeah, well, don't think I don't want to give up sometimes.
Yeah, we've been having some problems with our audio, so Kat's very much on the end of her rope right now.
Yeah, I'm a little grumpy, but I think everything is okay.
I think we've worked it out. Yeah, poor Katie, when she had to edit the podcast when you were gone the other week, and she was having a really bad time of it.
Yeah, I know. I saw that. Bad times all around.
Technology. It rules.
But the boss is back.
The boss is back. Everyone pretend to work.
Boss is back in town. Boss is back in town. But, well, we're going to take it a little easy this week. We're going to talk a little bit about the games that we're playing over the holiday season, and we're going to be talking about, we're going to do our Final Fantasy IX wrap up. I don't know about you, Katie, but I was delving a bit into my backlog. I totally thought that I was going to be playing a lot of Xenoblade Chronicles 2 because I've been really enjoying it and everything, and it's an easy game that for me to just kind of pick up on my Switch. But I ended up playing a game that I never expected.
Which is that?
Witcher 3.
Yeah, that's going back into a backlog of sorts, I suppose.
Yeah, no, totally. I was thinking that I was going to be playing a lot of Xenoblade Chronicles 2, as I already said. But instead, the Witcher 3 Xbox One X performance patch came out.
Right.
And as you may know, I have an Xbox One X now,
so you bring it to
ended
you.
Up reviewing it. Yeah. I would never have bought it otherwise, like, because it's just too expensive.
Yeah, it's pretty
pricey. $500, and I don't need... And while I have a nice 4K TV, I already got a PS4 Pro, so I'm just like, it's kind of a hard sell, even though the Xbox One X is self-evidently way better than the PS4 Pro in a lot of different regards.
Yeah.
But I had one, so I was like, all right, I'll download this Witcher 3 performance patch.
Let's do it.
Now is as good a time as any just to see, like, how it is. And the next thing I knew, I got totally hooked on it again.
Oh, well, it's really one of those games I got to play because I wanted to play it. I know I'd love it, but I haven't gotten around to it. And, I mean, I can't take advantage of the performance boost because I don't have a 4K TV, but it's just a good game in itself.
Well, you can play it in 60 frames per second then.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, they added a new patch that enables you to be able to play it in 60 frames per second or 4K.
Oh.
Though it's a little weird because I was selecting 4K, or I was selecting 60 frames per second just to see, like, the differences, but I kept switching back to 4K, and I couldn't tell, like, I couldn't tell. It sounds like that was some kind of bug, but I think
funny.
That you would really like Witcher 3.
I probably would. It takes, like, it's a very compelling sort of environment, and it's one of the best open worlds out there. Like, I mean, I understand that even Breath of the Wild took influence from Witcher 3, so if Nintendo's taking... examples from you, you're probably doing something right.
For me, this game has been kind of the slowest of burns over the years because I just... This game really takes its sweet time with everything.
Which
it
is
really
okay.
does. There's so much dialogue. There's so much watching these characters interact with one another. Mm-hmm. And there are times where I've been like, even in this current playthrough, where I've just been like, oh my God, get to the point. There's a main quest where you have to go talk to like a half dozen townsfolk because you're looking for the whereabouts of one person.
Right.
Like your old buddy Dandelion, who you don't know where he is.
Is his name really Dandelion?
Yeah, his name's totally Dandelion because he's a he's a bit of a fop. He's a minstrel.
Okay.
So. He's apparently appeared in the previous games as like one of your tag-along friends.
Oh.
And you need to find him. So, and they're like, yeah, talk to like freaking everybody.
Has anyone seen this weird bard just kind of hanging around?
That's basically what it amounts to. And so there's no game to it. You're just wandering around talking to people. And I get that it's advancing the story and you get to meet these kind of interesting characters. At one point you meet this shop owner who apparently is just all about costumes and has no compunction whatsoever about wearing women's clothing, which, cool. I think that was like a fun little sequence and everything. But so there's a certain point where I was just like, I want to get back to hunting monsters. God.
You go to his shop and he's just like serving you in women's clothes saying, hey, how's it going?
So a few things about Witcher 3. Mm-hmm. Man, that game is gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of
it
the best
gorgeous.
Looking games I've ever seen. And it looks so much better now on the Xbox One X.
Right.
It runs so smoothly. The environment the terrain is so varied and interesting and detailed. Mm-hmm. It's just a real pleasure to ride across that world and look up at the sky and see all the really interesting lighting effects and all the really interesting weather and everything.
Yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful world.
That's what I love about open worlds is getting to just kind of get on a horse and ride across it. That's the thing I love most about Breath of the Wild.
It's also really dense.
Which is nice.
It feels like there's so much to do. Mm-hmm. I look at my quest log, and so a lot of RPGs, BioWare does this, like Middle Earth, The Shadow War, it has like this bloat in it where it's like, go help the herbalist collect 30 of these like stupid herbs that you don't care about.
These stupid weeds you don't care about.
Whereas the side quests in Witcher 3, so you have the main quests, but then you have the side quests and it's like, go help so-and-so overthrow the ruler of this country. I'm
cool.
Like, ooh.
That sounds interesting.
Cool, okay.
I can do
or,
that.
Or your buddy was like doing this thing, but what was going on with them? Maybe you should go find out. Like every single one of them has a story hook to them.
Which is nice, yeah.
And sometimes they don't go anywhere, but almost always there's at least some interesting little thing that happened in it. What were you going to say?
I was just going to say, one thing about Xenoblade Chronicles 2 is I was a little bit critical of the side quests when I reviewed the game. But, I mean, there's like so many of them, and not all of them are very good, but there are a few, actually, that do have really good story hooks, and I was glad to learn that was the thing. And, in fact, almost every rare blade you get, each one has its own story quest that helps it grow, which I think was a really nice touch.
I think the thing that I really like about Witcher 3 is the way that all of the quests slowly but surely build up the world until it all comes together in kind of a major finale. This is happening to me right now. Like, I've been undertaking all of these different quests in a city called Novigrad, which is this like huge city. I've been getting a real feel for the politics that are going on there. Even though I didn't play Witcher 2.
Right.
And I'm running into these characters from Witcher 2 and the books.
and the books.
I have a pretty good feel for what's going on. I mean, I don't want to spoil too much, but the long and the short of it is that witches and wizards are being persecuted by a somewhat kind of a jerk of a king. And so you're like helping out the witches and wizards if you want. You're like meeting up with your old flame, Triss from the previous game.
Okay,
there was
this
great sequence where I went to help somebody escape from this oppressive regime. and it was a mask ball, so we had to buy masks and like outfits, and where I got to rekindle the flame with Triss.
Did you have sex on a unicorn? Because I know that's a thing.
No, I don't think we ever had sex on a unicorn. I think we were in a lighthouse.
Oh, okay.
It was very Simpsons.
That's also romantic.
Yeah, we were in a lighthouse or something. we were rekindling our flames. But no, like, it was the... We were chasing each other through a picturesque garden, and then we sat down on the bench, and we started making out, and it was very hot.
That sounds very not Geralt, but that sounds like the least Geralt thing I've ever heard of.
Yeah, it's a little weird listening to him share his feelings in that gruff Batman voice.
Yeah, doesn't he have, like, some that really, like, sort of, like, Eastern European accent?
He doesn't have an Eastern European accent. He just sounds like Batman.
Eastern
it's like
European
this
Batman.
Low, gravelly voice.
That's kind of cute.
I opted to keep him clean shaven with the hair long and down. I took it out of the ponytail.
Oh, okay. So that's very romantic.
And then after the mask ball, I kept the mask.
And you just kind of wear it everywhere?
So now he's like Char.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's always wearing the mask, the wolf mask. And Emily was just like, that looks stupid. Take that off.
Like, no,
I was
it's
like,
my
no. He looks amazing now, and I'm keeping this on for the rest of the game.
He's a furry now.
Whenever I get bored, I can just kind of wander off and do something else.
Mm-hmm. Which is nice.
I went and undertook this really long and involved scavenger hunt quest where I was getting the blueprints for this Witcher gear. And then I had to craft it all. Mm-hmm. And once I crafted it all, it looked really awesome.
That's awesome.
And was quite powerful. Like, so powerful, in fact, that a lot of the battles have actually become a little bit trivial.
Whoops. It happens.
Yeah. And then you can keep upgrading it, and you get, like, passive bonuses and everything. So I did that. And then there are, like, a zillion monster quests.
Of course.
It's now getting to the point where I'm actually getting a little overleveled for the story content because I've been doing so much stuff. But I never do side quests, Nadia. I am not a side quest person. So it just tells you how compelling this game is and I want to.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Definitely a game I need to start on sooner than later. I need to stop procrastinating on that because I know I'd like it. It's really one of those games where I know I'd like it. I need to get off my ass.
Well, it's such a rich world.
Exactly.
And the characters are so... well-developed, and I like that the relationships feel really mature, especially when it comes to Triss and Geralt. They've been a kind of an on-and-off, on-again, on-off-again relationship going back to at least the previous game. And so there's a lot of kind of very adult, like, what are we doing? Like, should we be doing this? What's going on?
That's adulthood, all right. Maybe we should do a Witcher 3 report. I get started.
No, forgot. For the love of God, that game's like 200 hours long.
Yeah, that is a bit of a... Well, Persona's not exactly short, but I guess it's not quite 200 hours long.
Well, okay, so it's more like 100 at least, but just the expansion packs by themselves are also like full games.
Right, of course, yeah. But I'm talking about like the core vanilla experience.
I feel daunted. It feels like there's too much to do.
Mm-hmm.
I want to do it. And I'm going to keep pushing through, and I'm really enjoying discovering all the monsters and everything. This is, for the first time, I've been kind of able to put aside the sense of disconnect that I have with Geralt.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he feels a little bit more like a character that I'm role-playing, and I'm enjoying. I'm getting into the world, finally, the characters. I'm getting in... Even the battle system isn't bugging me as much, because I'm having a good time... Now that my spells are a little more powerful,
right.
They're fun to use. It feels fun to parry attacks and like slice off heads, and that kind of thing. It's fun to fight monsters. It's really satisfying to find the right combinations of oils. It's a much deeper game than it looks.
Yeah. So you went back to you backslid a little bit. I think we all did it. We talked about this on the US Gamer podcast where we all had these backlogs or whatever, these newer games that we were going to try, and we all just kind of retreated to our comfort zones.
Well, I wouldn't really say that this was my comfort zone exactly.
Right.
It's a generational game, though.
True.
Like, this is the kind of game that when it's all said and done and we're looking back on the past 5 years of gaming, past decade of gaming, we're going to say that this is one of the best games, if
Absolutely.
Not the best game
it's definitely important.
Of the entire generation.
Yeah, definitely one of the most important games to come out in recent years.
Yeah, so I just feel, as an RPG fan, as somebody who appreciates good games, I've always admired the hell out of Witcher 3, mm-hmm. but it's always been such a slow burn.
Yeah.
You've really had to get into it. Like, the beginning is so slow.
Talking to 20 people to find out where Dandelion went to.
Yeah, that it's, and like I said, the game takes its sweet time. There's a point where, so I told you I got this sweet Witcher gear, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, sweet, I got this Witcher, I have to be another level up. I have to level up to be able to use this Witcher's gear.
Oh.
I have to get to level 11. I'm currently level 10. And it took forever to get to level 11.
Of course.
And now I'm like level 17 or something like that.
No, you're so flying along.
I've leveled up. Like, suddenly I started leveling up much faster, mm-hmm. almost too fast. But yeah, no, there was a point where it just felt like I was not leveling up at all.
Yeah.
And the story had stalled out a little bit. But now I'm at a point where it's kind of moving
yeah,
along.
You kind of went over that hump.
So, like, we can do a Witcher 3 report if the listeners are interested. But if we do a Witcher 3 report, it's going to be like a year-long endeavor.
It's going to go on for a while, yeah. I can't remember how long Persona 4 took. But
it would be nice to take a break from Japanese RPGs.
Yeah, there's that.
And kind of flip over and talk about a game that's kind of generationally great. So, I don't know if you have thoughts. USGamer@USGamer.net. Tell me what you want the next report to be. And hey, we can do this over the next couple of years. Content!
Content, yes. Important content. Very valuable content. Good content.
All of the content.
All of the content.
But I'm going to keep playing through Witcher 3. I'm also playing another RPG, Nadia.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
So, did I mention that when I went to England, I started playing Darkest Dungeon?
I think so, yes. You streamed it.
I downloaded it onto my iPad and started a new run with it.
Oh, do you hate life and everything sunny and good about the world? Like, just want to punish yourself?
Are you asking me if I've just been totally taken over by the blood curse?
Yes.
And my stress meter has gone through the roof?
Yes.
And I've become afflicted and abusive?
Yes.
No, I still like life, and life is funny. It's just a great game. Have I ever, like, really told you about this game, Nadia?
I think so, but I am okay with hearing about it again.
Yes, this is why I like you, because you're always okay with me, like, blathering on about this. So Darkest Dungeon is a game where you get lots of party members coming in each week, and you put them together in a party, and you send them down into a dungeon, and mm-hmm. if they die in that dungeon, they die.
Yeah, they're gone.
And if their stress meter, they have a little stress meter, if the stress meter reaches the top, they go crazy.
Nice, yeah.
Or they find hidden reserves and depths that they did not know about.
So they become saiyans.
And become virtuous.
Virtuous saiyans.
Yes, and then proceed to encourage everybody instead mm-hmm. and keep stress down, which can be
that's interesting.
Really nice. But there are something like 12 different hero classes, mm-hmm. and they are all very different.
Of course.
And interact with each other very differently in a lot of different levels. And my absolute favorite thing to do in an RPG is to build teams.
Mm-hmm.
I love having to agonize over my party composition.
Shudder.
One of the reasons that I had the hardest time getting to Witcher 3 is that there's no party.
You're right. It's just Geralt.
Yeah. So you're a lone wanderer as opposed to a party composition, as opposed to doing a party composition. It's the same with Fallout.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, like I like, because it's not just the abilities and everything. There's role-playing in the abilities. There's role-playing in what party you favor. Do you like prefer high damage output, like just blitz them down as fast as possible? Do you prefer something tankier? Do you prefer damage over time? Do you like more classical combinations, or do you like to experiment and go crazy and everything?
Mm-hmm.
And Darkest Dungeon kind of lets you do everything.
Yeah, it would.
Last night, I was sitting on my iPad, and I was reading through a party composition mega thread that had like 13 or 14 different, extremely different mm-hmm. party compositions with all of the quirks and all of the trinkets and everything. And I'm just like, I am in heaven. This is the greatest thing ever.
I bet you were. And I bet, like, I think you've probably mentioned it before, but you probably love the hell out of Final Fantasy V then.
No, I don't.
What?
I thought like I the characters. You.
True, true.
I've always said that story is not that important to me, mm-hmm. except when it's detrimental.
That's a good
philosophy.
Final
Fantasy V's story is so boring.
True. I agree with that.
And the characters are so not interesting, except for the pirate.
Pirate's really cool. What's her name? Ferris, yeah.
Yeah, Ferris is all right. But I don't particularly care for anybody else. It's also bog standard. And the way that they're introduced, when the comet just arrives, mm-hmm. and you're like, Bartz or Butts or whatever his name is, shows up on a chocobo and is riding around in a field and goes, oh, hello, random person. Oh, hello, random person. Hi, guy who just apparently showed up on a comet.
He came
for a party
moon.
Now. Let's go.
Yay, let's go adventuring. You're right.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
A good point.
And yeah, so, but yeah, you're right. To a certain extent, mm-hmm. I do find the mechanics really interesting in that game. But Darkest Dungeon is much more interesting to me because, first of all, it's a lot prettier.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Five
and
is kind of primitive.
That game is all about strategic grinding.
Right.
So you are basically trying to decide where to spend your money, how to level up your characters, what to invest in. Mm-hmm. Because you only have a finite number of resources, heirlooms, gold, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. And you have to figure out, like, do I invest in this character or are they too far gone? Do I just need to get rid of them?
You just send them to their deaths in the dungeon.
No, you don't send them to the death. You just dismiss them.
Oh, okay. It's actually really interesting because you're talking about this world where, yes, a stress meter is very much a part of the gameplay, and that makes a lot of sense because dungeon spelunking cannot be a stress-free endeavor. So you have these people who are, by the sounds of it, selling their heirlooms and their savings to go adventuring and possibly die in this horrible, stressed-out hole, and yet they really want to do it. That's really interesting.
Well, they're all different. They all have different reasons for going. Like, you have crusaders who are investals who are extremely religious.
Right, okay.
You have grave robbers who are just, you know, kind of awful.
Yeah, they're a little bit.
Grave robbers, highwaymen, abominations. They all have their reasons for coming. Some are fairly unsavory types.
Okay,
some are
that makes sense.
Fairly heroic. The DLC that came out last year has a character called the Flagellant.
Yeah.
Who is covered in bandages and everything, and I guess they hurt themselves for religion.
Wow, that's really cool.
They believe in pain. Pain will make you pure.
Okay, so no wonder they're going to this hellhole.
Yes, exactly. So they're all fanatics in kind of their own way. And the DLC. So the cool thing about this game is that you can transfer the save from the iPad over to the PC, which mm-hmm. I did,
right.
And I streamed it yesterday, actually.
Right.
Now, the PC version has DLC, and you can activate the DLC onto a save. And the DLC adds a new dungeon, but it totally changes the mechanics. So the way it works is you'll suddenly get an invitation to come down to the Crimson Court. Mm-hmm. And it'll look like a regular dungeon at first. And you're like, doop-de-doop, this is fine.
This is
boy,
fine.
This regular short dungeon is a lot longer than I was expecting. Man, this is going on for a long time. Mm-hmm. And it's normally when you go into a dungeon, you have like a torch and you have to keep the light level up.
Right.
Well, instead, the light is fairly consistent.
Mm.
So you don't have to worry about that. But the reason you want torches is that they increase your accuracy. And also you come across these cocoons. And if you open a cocoon, enemies come out
mm-hmm.
because they're all like bug creatures.
Ew.
And,
no, thanks.
If you wear headphones, you hear that horrible like mosquito like whine in the background.
Oh, I hate that. Nothing's worse than that sound.
Yeah, but you burn the cocoons to lower the stress of your heroes.
Right.
And then you keep going until you reach you run into a boss, and you're not even expecting to run into a boss. And the game, like, totally fakes you out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's bad, because this is a very strong boss. So if you didn't bring a really good party, you might be screwed.
Right.
And if you go too early into this DLC dungeon, you're doubly screwed. Mm-hmm. You're probably going to lose everybody.
Oh, my gosh.
And if you lose everybody, if you get a party wipe, you lose all the trinkets and everything,
wow.
And they're dead.
Oof. Yeah. Talk about stress
levels.
Yeah,
that's really rough. So the first time I went down into this, I brought a character called the... I forget what that character is called, but they basically are there to grind gold.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they can't do anything, really. They can only kind of hide and defend themselves. But they are really, really good because they are constantly generating trinkets and gold
mm-hmm.
and like artifacts that you can sell for a lot of money. And so you want to bring them onto runs where you're just like, I'm going down to make money now.
Yeah. Money runs.
Well, I brought him along. I didn't exactly have the greatest party, but thankfully I was overleveled enough that I managed to beat the boss, who was really tough.
Right.
It was like this crocodile that was hiding among these reeds, and often he would dive underwater and heal himself and then pop up and do this attack called Apex Predator that would do a ton of damage to one character. I ended up losing the gold grinder.
Oh no, the portable gold hobbit.
Yeah, he totally bled out.
Did you
call him
gold?
A portable gold hobbit?
I don't know. I'm picturing this little tiny like thing that just poops gold or just sweats gold or something and just trailing behind your party. I don't know. I haven't seen it.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. And I will say no else. But so in any case, I have a high level party. I finally got a character up to level 6, which is the top level. It's the champion level.
Nice.
And I'm in the veteran dungeons now, and I'm kind of clearing those out. And then potentially I will get to the point where I can take on the darkest dungeon.
Oh, so not even in the darkest dungeon, the titular darkest dungeon yet.
That's the final dungeon.
Oh, geez.
And you have to go running through it four times.
Right.
At the end of which is the final boss.
Wow. So if you lose everyone, you have to start over again, huh? Like just from square one.
Yeah, but I'm playing in a thing called Radiant Mode, so they've made a ton of improvements to the game, because when this game first came out, I bounced on it because I was just like, there's too much grinding.
Yeah.
It's too grindy. I can't keep doing this. I'm going to go crazy. And this is boring. And if I lose people, then they're gone, and I can't start from scratch. That's just way too much.
Yeah.
But now, like, there's a... So now you can upgrade the wagons so higher level heroes show up.
Mm-hmm.
So you can keep adding in higher level heroes to your party just as they like randomly appear.
Right.
You can grind a lot more easily with certain characters. And there's a thing called Radiant Mode, which dramatically shortens the game. Like it shortens it from like 100 hours to like 40.
Right.
Still pretty long.
Still,
but
yeah.
Without changing the difficulty or anything, and you can level up heroes much more quickly.
Oh, that's good. So it throws you a little bit of a bone there.
Yeah, a little bit. But there's still a lot to do, because I'm in the middle of the veteran level dungeons, but then there's also the Crimson Court, and the Crimson Court has these epic length dungeons, which are like 100 rooms.
Wow.
Yeah, like that's crazy town. Because your average dungeon will have like a dozen rooms at most.
Right.
So an epic length dungeon, the only good thing is that the maps are fixed.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are also like keys and things that you have to retrieve to open certain doors. It's almost like the original Legend of Zelda.
That's what I was thinking of, yeah.
So I'm like, I don't know if I want to actually try to take this on.
Go play more Witcher 3.
And the other annoying thing is I've got my iPad version, which the DLC is not out on the iPad yet.
Right. I was wondering about that. I guess not.
So I can't just transfer the save back and keep going. So now I have a separate save without the DLC. And I'm like, do I want to keep playing without the DLC? I mean, the DLC is pretty cool and interesting and adds a lot of different things and new classes and all that. But it also means that just sitting on being tied to my computer rather than just being able to break out my iPad whenever.
Yeah.
Which is the reason I got back into it, was because I could just go on a random run with my party and be like, doop, doop, doop. Anyway, this game's going to be out on the Nintendo Switch very soon if you're interested in it.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Hopefully it's a decent port. The nice thing about the Switch version is it'll have a much bigger screen than the Vita version while retaining the portability and also have a touch screen. So
you'll
be able to enjoy it.
Kind of that in between with the iPad and the Vita. So I might hate myself enough to give it a try. I guess.
You wouldn't like it.
Probably not.
It's a very hardcore RPG.
Yeah.
That is just mostly obsessing about party compositions and everything. It's very grindy. And also, it has a story.
Right.
And the story's interesting. It's all about how, like, this character called the Ancestor kind of fell into these crazy experiments and started summoning horrific forces from the underworld and everything, and you have to basically clean up his mess is what it all comes down to.
Right.
And that's That's a fairly interesting story.
Yeah, I mean, but I liked Etrian Odyssey 5, but that's as hardcore as I want to get.
Yeah, I mean, Etrian Odyssey 5 is maybe a smidge less hardcore than this game.
Yeah, yeah. But it also has no real tying story, but I found it, like, compelling enough to keep on going.
Yeah, it's just a different taste, mm-hmm. and I kind of want to keep playing it. I really like this game, and I want to beat it. I kind of want to beat it, the vanilla version. I kind of want to beat the DLC, and they've got more DLC coming at a certain point called The Color of Madness. There's too much to do.
There really is. Too many RPGs to play.
I could play this game forever, mm-hmm. but I got other RPGs. Speaking of other RPGs, and Nadia, I've been delving into my backlog. I've been playing games from like a couple years ago, but you went even further back. You played a game from like 20 years ago.
I went all the way back to, gosh, 1995, I guess, in both cases, because yes, what happened was for Christmas, my husband got me two retro games, SNES. I have Terranigma, a repro cart, and I have Secret of Evermore, the actual article, and I have been playing both over the holiday, and that's been very interesting. I have my nice flat-screen CRT TV, and I've been just kind of chilling along, chugging along. Good times.
Oh, man, I so want a flat-screen CRT television. I wish I could totally justify being able to actually get that.
Yeah, they I was actually on the Square Roots podcast over the holiday, and we were talking about how not only are they getting rarer, these CRT televisions, but also getting more expensive.
Yeah, I mean, because they're just becoming harder and harder to find because nobody actually makes them.
Yeah,
you got one of the big fat ones, right?
Yeah, I got one of the big fat ones that weigh like 60,000 pounds. So if it falls on me, I'm dead. But in the meantime, I have a really good TV to play the SNES on, and I'm really glad that I got it when I did. It came out like right before HDTVs became a thing, so it was really one of the last ones they produced, and it's a really nice little article.
I would love to have one of those little CR televisions, like the Sony ones.
Yeah, yes.
Retronauts did a really great episode about different retro displays and like what the optimal one is.
Oh, I bet Parrish knows all about that.
There's a very particular TV that you want to find, but you really have to invest money in it because it's expensive as hell. So, I would love to get one of those, but I know that it would just sit on my desk with like, I don't know, a Super Nintendo or whatever, and I would never play it.
Well, they're good for the cats, too. The cats get to sit on it while they don't get to do that on TVs anymore.
Yeah.
So they have a spot.
All right. Secret of Evermore. So when this game came out, it was pretty confusing to a lot of people.
Yes, it was, because the name Secret of Evermore implies that, hey, this is a sequel to Secret of Mana, which it is not. Secret of Evermore is yeah, believe it or not, it is an American-developed game. And
what?
Even though it has the Secret of title in it, story-wise, it does nothing to link to Square's Japanese title.
But it was also published by Square.
It was published by Square, yeah. I think Ted Woolsey worked on it.
Heightening the confusion even more.
Yeah, it is very confusing. When I look back, I'm like, wow, they shouldn't have named the Secret of anything, because number one of the reasons it was kind of scorned back in the day is because people thought we got it instead of Seeking Densetsu 3/Secret of Mana 2, which isn't the case. It's just that Secret of Mana 2 was, I believe, maybe too big and too complex to localize to bring out.
They literally could not fit it on the cart.
Yeah, we're talking about a game that took up like every inch of space in Japanese, and of course Japanese text is a lot more compact than English text, so it would have added that much more space to the cart that they just weren't willing to do. But Secret of Evermore, the reason why it's even called that, I believe, is because it utilizes a lot of the systems from Secret of Mana. You have the ring menus, you have like the action RPG sort of element where you have to wait until you got 100% power before you can attack. You've got magic, sort of, but it's kind of an alchemy system. I haven't figured that out yet. I haven't really gotten deep enough into the game to really get a good feel for it. But otherwise, it's a very unique beast, because it's a little bit ahead of its time as far as console-based Western RPGs go. Because by that point in time, of course, there were PC RPGs that were Western-made, but consoles, we were just getting used to Japanese RPGs, let alone like Western RPGs. So with Secret of Evermore, you have like the more subdued color palette. You have the more subdued soundtrack. Of course, it was actually composed by, I'm going to butcher his last name, Jeremy Soule, who does the Elder Scrolls games now, including Skyrim. Oh. Yeah, so he goes for a more atmospheric kind of soundtrack as opposed to a more in-your-face, like, do-do-do-do battle theme, you know, upbeat sort of thing. So, yeah, it's an interesting game. Not as good, of course, as Chrono Trigger or Final Fantasy VI, but I appreciate it for existing, and I am going to continue going, seeing how far I get, see if I get fed up or if I just keep on kind of finding interest in it.
What do you like about it most?
It's got this really weird sense of humor. I mean, one reason I think it would not fly in at the time is because the story does not take itself seriously at all. The protagonist is literally a no-name kid who is hanging out with his dog, and his idea of character building is to quote made-up movies from that universe.
So he's a nerd.
He's a total movie nerd. It has a very American feel to it, like kind of like the way Earthbound does, but except it's actually done by an American company. So the story starts off with this flashback in the 60s, and you see this town with this, like, you know, bijou theater, and it looks really nice, and then, like, you flash forward to 1980, and it's all broken down and worn out, worn out sort of cityscape. I also like the dog. There's a, because you play as the boy and his dog, literally, and the dog changes forms as you go from time era to time era, because it's a kind of a game about time travel. And I just like systems that you play as dogs. You don't get that too often in RPGs. That was one thing that always irritated me about Earthbound, was you started out with a dog, but then you lost him very quickly.
I like any RPG that has a dog as a character.
Yeah, it's hard to say no to a dog.
Persona 3 totally has a dog as a character.
Does it?
Yeah, and you can totally take him out for walks and stuff.
Does he fight?
That's how you bond with him, is that you take the dog out for walks.
That's hilarious.
And the dog can also fight in your party and everything. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's one of my favorite characters. Obviously, I love Amaterasu.
Yeah.
Which, not an RPG per se, but I love that character. Darkest Dungeon has the Houndmaster.
Oh, nice.
Who has a little puppet, has a puppy that walks along with him. And the dog can... you can mark enemies. The dog can hit everybody and cause them to bleed.
Cool.
Or can just rush them.
Yeah.
And if you're camping, you can have it do a hound's watch.
Mm-hmm.
And keep everybody from being ambushed, and can also scout ahead for you and scout out the next room. So, yeah, very useful animal. The Houndmaster is definitely one of the best classes. So, but more broadly, if there's a dog, I'm always going to pick the dog.
Yeah, me too. That's one thing I loved about Twilight Princess. I liked playing as Wolf Link.
Yes.
That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I love playing as Wolf Link with Midna.
Yeah.
That was the absolute best part of that game.
I agree. I know people didn't like the Twilight Realm so much, but once you're able to control Link and have him, like, morph at will, that was a lot of fun.
I agree. The actual Twilight Realms, where you had to go through and solve the puzzles and find the thing, mm-hmm. and kill the enemies. Not super fun, but I really enjoyed the act of turning into Link turning into Wolf Link in the way that people would interact with you differently if you were a wolf.
Yeah, you could talk to
usually
the cats.
Freaking out, running away.
Yeah. Yeah, you could talk to the cats, and the cats would say these really deep philosophical things. It was really adorable.
Yes, I totally remember that. Yeah, you could talk to all the animals.
Yeah. And you could talk to Epona, and Epona would be like, I know it's really you deep down inside, Master. Like, aw. Thanks, horse.
But if I may say, with, like, Secret of Evermore, I think that it was an expectation thing as much as the actual quality of the game.
Yeah.
Because, first of all, when you hear Secret of Evermore, you assume another Secret of Mana type game.
Yeah.
But this is not a fantasy game,
no.
Seemingly. I mean, it's more Earthboundy in a lot of respects.
Yeah, it's more, really more sci-fi. More of a mm-hmm. sci-fi setting than a fantasy setting. I think even Earthbound is more feels more fantasy than, I guess because maybe it has that brighter color palette.
So that'll totally, like, throw you for a loop, right?
Yeah. It's funny, when Secret of Evermore was first announced for the SNES, I thought, oh man, I'm getting that, because I kind of thought it was like a follow-up to Secret of Mana. But then Chrono Trigger came out first, and I said, well, I really want a game now. And since Secret of Evermore got delayed, I guess in favor of Chrono Trigger, I said, I'll get Chrono Trigger instead. And I did, and I guess it was a better purchase either way.
Secret of Evermore, not exactly remembered as an all-time classic, but it's kind of cool that you're going back and delving into maybe this kind of forgotten RPG.
Yeah,
I look forward to your thoughts.
It's definitely forgotten. It was definitely a bit of an expensive cartridge, from what I understand, because it didn't...
So was everything at that time.
Yeah, no, that's true, but I mean on the secondary market, because I don't think it sold that
kinda
well.
Kind of rare.
Yeah, so it's kind
of rare. Probably didn't get much of a production run, for sure.
No, I highly doubt it, because it's an RPG to begin with, and then like people were expecting something in the vein of Secret of Mana, and of course they didn't get that. So
for the longest time, I saw the name Secret of Evermore and just assumed that it was kind of a fantasy game. Like, and I think a lot of people were the same way when it popped up on in Nintendo Power and that kind of thing.
Yeah, it definitely deserves a second chance, and I'm looking forward to just kind of going through it and seeing what I think of it now in hindsight.
Speaking of giving games second chances, I think it's time to move on, Nadia, and talk about, do our Final Fantasy IX report wrap up.
Yeah, may as well.
It's been about a month now since you actually wrapped up Final Fantasy IX, so...
Yeah, it's been a little while.
It's not as fresh in your memory, but maybe you have a little bit of a benefit of distance.
Mm-hmm.
So, having now played through the entirety of Final Fantasy IX, you've got that notch on your belt, you've gotten it out of your backlog, you can say that you're done. Overall thoughts?
Overall, it definitely ranks up with my upper pantheon of favorite Final Fantasy games. Still not quite my favorite. I still say prefer 6. I actually prefer 7 as well. 4. So I wouldn't say it's in my top 3, but definitely in my top 5.
Interesting. So you prefer 7. I don't know if that's like a controversial statement, but I'm sure that among a certain subset of Final Fantasy fans that they would be like, really? 7 over 9?
Yeah, okay. Here's the thing. I will admit nostalgia. 7... came to me, of course, during the formative years of my life, and it's just a really intense game to play at that time of your life. I admit that. But 9 also has problems in terms of its mechanics. It is very, very slow. I think I might have even gotten fed up with it, playing it without the benefit of the fast-forward function and having to sit through every friggin' scene, battle loading. Oh my god. It's bad in 7. It's so much worse than 9.
It doesn't hold up, in other words.
Not in terms of its mechanics. I enjoyed its soundtrack is fantastic. Its graphics, that's probably why we got such a crappy load time, is because the graphics are very good. The new graphics, like, they did a really good job. The backgrounds are a little bit blurry, but the polygons look all nice and crisp now. But yeah, just in terms of the load times, not a fan.
Yeah, sadly, old PlayStation games just don't hold up that well, do they?
No, unfortunately. It's a bit of a shame, but I'm really glad I played it. I feel like the story falls apart a bit in the third act. Again, bringing up Square Root's podcast, which I was on, the host, John, said he had a perfect term for it, which is Disc 3 Crazy, which is what you refer to like as a Square game or any sort of RPG that kind of loses its mind in the third act. I wouldn't say it's...
Like, in what way?
Just, like, when things go a little bit off the rails. I wouldn't say 9 is quote-unquote crazy, but I do feel like the story takes kind of a weird turn in the third act with Terra and Garland and all of that. Like, it's just this... We did talk about how... that whole issue with Terra and Gaia and everything that happened within was a callback to Chaos and from Final Fantasy I and the time loop and all of that. But I don't know, I just feel like it was just not as well put together as it could have been. It wasn't terrible by any means, but I felt like I wasn't spending... I feel like the time could have been better spent developing the character who didn't get a lot of face time in the game.
So Freya.
I can't even remember the name of that that red-haired jerk who just joins your party.
Oh, Amaranth.
Amaranth, that's it. I barely used him.
I never used him because I didn't like the character design.
Yeah, what the hell's up with him? I'm like, are you like, he looks like a lion who got his head run over. It's just, I don't understand what was going on. I used him for a little bit. You kind of got a better idea of who Iko is, so there was that at least. But, yeah.
Amaranth felt like a last-minute throw-in.
He really did, didn't he?
Almost like they were like, we're a character short. We really need to have at least one more character that people can pick from.
This guy,
I guess.
Okay, sure. It's too bad because Vivi had a fantastic character arc. Garnet had a great character arc. Zidane, even though I didn't like so much where his story went, he still had a character arc. Iko had kind of a character arc. Freya just fell to the wayside, which is too bad. She was really interesting.
Yeah, she definitely, her arc, once it kind of wrapped up around the mid game, she definitely faded into the background and became a supporting character, even though I really liked her.
Yeah, it's like, first of all, she's a dragoon. I love dragoons. She's a female dragoon. You don't see those very often. And she's a
female rat-girl dragoon.
Yeah. Man, she was perfect.
So random. On the subject of Zidane's arc, I think that it actually works because it's kind of in the vein of Final Fantasy VII in that you have a really confident hero who initially comes off as maybe the most charismatic and most optimistic of all of them, who by the end is forced to question who he is and what his place is in the world. Like, everything he thought he knew is thrown to the wayside, and he has to rebuild. Either he has to persevere or he has to be totally broken by it. And of course, both Cloud and Zidane ultimately are able to kind of find themselves in that regard.
And I'm actually okay with that. I was fine with the idea of Zidane being this confident hero who's broken down and has to build himself back up. But I just mean, like, the whole subplot with Terra and Gaia and the souls, it's just like, oh, okay.
But it's not a subplot. It's like the main plot,
you know what I mean? Yeah.
They set it up almost from the very beginning with the mist and all of that. And in fact, one of the major themes of the entire game is just this whole kind of finding yourself. Who are you? What is this world? Everything not being kind of what it seems, and that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's true. But I just didn't find it as interesting as it could have been, I guess.
I suppose.
Yeah.
I think that this game is the most Final Fantasy game you're possibly going to find.
That's true, yeah.
It's just, it hauls out every single trope and lovingly puts it out there as, this is Final Fantasy, all right.
You want a Final Fantasy? Or shove it down your throat.
The whole circle of life with the souls returning to the earth and then being hijacked via a tree.
Via a tree, yeah. That sounds about Final Fantasy-ish.
The sudden and crazy sci-fi turn, the kind of steampunk look to everything. The many, many, many airships.
Yes, I did like so many airships. I did love the designs for the airships, especially the Hildegard 3.
And there's sort of everybody going through this existential crisis, which was definitely a thing that started in Final Fantasy VI for the most. I mean, it felt like Final Fantasy picked it up with Cecil. They saw how popular Cecil was in Final Fantasy IV. Who kind of had his own little existential crisis of, do I want to be working for this evil king?
Yeah.
And then, of course, making his big decision on, what was it, Mount Ordeals, whatever.
Yeah.
And eventually said, no, I am your brother. That kind of thing.
I am your father. I mean, oops, I am your brother.
And then Final Fantasy VI obviously did it in a much more interesting and like kind of compelling way.
Yeah.
And that kind of continued, I don't know, until, I mean, it's always been more or less a part of Final Fantasy, but it was definitely at its height in Final Fantasy VII and IX, for sure.
Yeah.
It's when games got emo.
I feel like Kuja wasn't the greatest villain, though.
Kuja is a little bit forgettable.
Yeah.
I remember at the time thinking, oh, sweet, it's another Sephiroth-type character who's kind of crazy. So he's kind of like Kefka meets Sephiroth.
Kefiroth, yeah.
Okay. He's very pretty. So I wanted the pretty boy characters back. I was annoyed that the villain of Final Fantasy VIII was this crazy sorceress.
Yeah, yeah. No, the pretty boy was back, all right, but he didn't really do very much. I mean, he did, but he was very flamboyant and very over the top, but he didn't really have a good reason to be.
I don't know, like, a lot of his arc is compensating for stuff.
That's true. He sure was compensating.
He was compensating for the fact that he was thrown away.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That he was basically worthless in the eyes of Garland. So he compensated by being extremely, almost annoyingly confident. And pretty.
He was very, very pretty, yeah. And speaking of Kuja, one thing that really was underutilized in the game was the trance system.
You think so?
I think so. I just feel like, I think Final Fantasy VI really nailed how it should be, where Terra had her, she could call upon her powers once she knew why she could wield them, and when, once she knew she could control them. And yeah, you have them for a limited amount of time, but you kind of can use them when they're convenient. How many times in this game did I, like, transform when I was one hit away from beating an enemy? And then, of course, you can't summon trance again until you get, like, kicked in the face enough times. So it just wasn't as handy as it could have been. And it's interesting because the transforms all looked very neat. Like, they all, I feel like each one had a story behind it that we never really found out.
Yeah, I definitely like the limit breaks in Final Fantasy VII and VIII better.
Yeah, me too.
Because in VII, of course, you had the meter that would just rise up until you were ready to use it, and then you could use it whenever, right?
Yeah.
It wouldn't reset?
No, I think you could take it from battle to battle. So if you were like at the end of a battle, you could just skip over the character's turn. And of course, the limit breaks are a little bit overpowered, no doubt. Although sometimes they balance that out, like with Vincent, he could turn into these weird, really OP monsters, but you couldn't control him. And he couldn't take him out of trance until the battle was over, which of course, if you were like that stupid Frankenstein monster and you use an electric attack against an electric enemy, you were screwed because it'd heal him every turn.
Yeah. And then Final Fantasy VIII had the limit breaks would become likely to activate when you were at a very low level or low HP.
Right.
So a viable strategy was to try to get your HP as low as possible so your limit break would activate basically every single turn. Which was how I seem to recall beating... Yeah, that's how I beat Omega Weapon at the end of the day, because there's a strategy you can use where you get everybody down to one HP, and then you use something called Holy War to make yourself invincible, and then you just spam limit breaks until it's dead.
Okay, whatever works, but at least you kind of got to control that strategy yourself. Again, Final Fantasy IX was just, you know, transform, oh, we're done.
So how exactly did the trans system work again?
From what I can gather, if you got hit enough or took enough damage, your secondary meter would fill up rather slowly unless you put like an accessory or a skill that would fill it up a little faster. And then you would transform. And each transform had, I think it had additional skills. Like one that was really handy was with Quina. Usually she has to get an enemy down to 25% of their HP before she can absorb their powers. But I think when she's tranced, it's 50%, so that's a much easier way to basically gather up blue spells. And I think Zidane had some kind of interesting skills too, as I recall. But I was really kind of more interested in how he turned into like a really hairy monkey. He grew extra hair.
Going full Dragon Ball on a
he went
all
totally
of us.
Super Saiyan 4. Yeah.
So a few things that I think Final Fantasy IX does extremely well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the characters that you described, Vivi, Garnet, Zidane, all very extremely well-developed.
Yeah, they did a really good job.
With very satisfying arcs.
Yes.
And a lot of depth and interesting. Also, I think it's the funniest Final Fantasy I've ever played. I have not played a funnier Final Fantasy.
It has a very... Final Fantasy VI, as much as I love it, it's really, really, really depressing game.
But it's also really slapstick.
Yeah.
Like Final Fantasy VI has its funny moments, but when it's trying to be funny, it's usually devolving into the little sprites going, you know, with the big eyes and they're kind of hopping around.
Yeah.
Like, wah! Right?
Yeah.
Very slapstick. Whereas Final Fantasy IX, I loved all of the little vignettes that you could randomly access, the active time events.
Yeah, those were all hilarious. Like, it was a very... It did a really good job balancing that serious stuff with the humor, which is hard to do, so...
And Steiner was hilarious.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Because Steiner Steiner is the perfect mix of extremely serious but totally absurd.
Yeah. To the game's credit, one thing that's really good about Steiner is that everyone knew how to play off him. Mm-hmm. So everyone knew he was ridiculous and they treated him as such, and that could get pretty funny.
But the key is, he's not a total joke.
No, he has his serious moments.
He has his moments where he's serious, and I think it's really important for these slapstick characters who are like often the butt of all the jokes, who are totally crazy, to have that lucid, grounded moment.
Yeah.
Because that endears them to you. So you got to have that little bit of drama, you got to have that little bit of comedy, and it makes both of those things pop that much more.
Like, basically, you weren't laughing at him when it counted. Like when he was teaming up with Beatrix towards the end of the game, and I think it was Alexandria was under attack from mist monsters, and like they were just pummeling the hell out of these things, and it's like, wow, that's pretty badass.
He was also one of the most powerful characters.
He was pretty ridiculous, yes, especially if you team him up with Vivi.
Yeah, and I like that Beatrix and Steiner end up together.
Yeah, that's really cute. I'm disappointed that you can't play as Beatrix, but I'm glad she didn't die. I was convinced she was going to die.
Yeah, I like that they tried to basically put her into Final Fantasy XV.
Oh, that's right.
That was the thing. It's like
the female
Final
dragon.
Fantasy XV had a Beatrix slash kind of Celeste character.
Yeah.
But she freaking disappears like toward the end of the game, and it's so annoying. I'm like, I love this character. Why can't she be more present in the events of the game?
Mm-hmm.
They actually finally stuck her in the DLC for Ignis.
No, I think was it Ignis or was it Prompto? Are you talking about the
Prompto?
The dragon?
Yeah, they teamed her up with Prompto, and I loved that.
Yeah, yeah. So at least she
didn't
totally
pretty rad. Her. But so yeah, aside from being extremely funny. And having extremely well-developed characters, it's also just a really vivid world. In a way that, see, Final Fantasy 6 through 9, no, 6 through 10, all benefited from just having these really great, interesting, well-realized worlds that were really coherent, and they were all different.
Yeah.
They all had this very decidedly different look. Mm-hmm. To them, I would throw in 12 in there as well. It didn't start to go off the rails until 13 and 15, where it just all of a sudden became this giant hodgepodge of things.
Yeah, but
6 through 12, whoo, exquisite.
Yeah, I would even give 15 the benefit of the doubt because 15 has like this walled kingdom and this world that's been ravaged by war.
Yeah,
so there is like that juxtaposition. But 13 tried a little hard.
The whiplash is too strong.
A little bit strong. Yeah. You can definitely see
whereas,
what this
like,
seems
Final
on that
Fantasy
game.
IX, like I love King Cid's, I love King Cid's hometown, the capital.
Yeah, I'm totally blanking on it, the name of it now, even though I know exactly what you're talking about. But yeah, that was a really interesting town. I love the Black Mage Village and how like secluded and overtaken by nature it is.
Mm.
Yeah, it's it.
I love the final dungeon. It looks really cool.
Yeah, that was really neat. I really liked that last dungeon, and the music there was fantastic as well.
I can totally understand why Sakaguchi considers Final Fantasy IX to be his favorite in the series.
Yeah.
Because, what were we going to say?
I was just going to say, it feels like, considering that he kind of left after all that, it does feel a bit like his opus.
Well, it feels like it's definitely his swan song.
Yeah.
And I'm sure for him it was just a crazy nostalgic game to actually make because he was looking back on, at that point, a decade of working on the same series and probably thinking about how far Square had come since he had made the original Final Fantasy. And
crazy.
At that time, Square was at the absolute height of its power.
Yeah.
And I mean, when he was working on the original Final Fantasy, he was just, you know, a developer.
Yeah.
And he was, at that point, like, executive vice president of Square, and he had all of these different projects going on and everything. He was making a movie. So, for him, that was, like, the culmination of so many different things. And he really kind of knocks it out of the park. It's a very emotional game
in that regard. Yeah, I really enjoyed my time with it. Like I said, it's not quite my... I guess it'd be my fourth favorite. Still looking at 6, then 7, then 4, then 9. Sorry, everyone. I loved it, but I love those three so much.
It definitely has a problem with holding up
in
the way that like Final Fantasy 4 and Final Fantasy 4, 6, 10 even kind of hold up maybe a little bit better. 12.
Yeah.
9, because it's just, it's beholden to the fact that A, it was on the PlayStation, and B, they were pushing the PlayStation to its absolute limit.
Yeah. Like I said, that's the thing that really brought it down for me was the mechanics and just how slow it was. I almost wish that you could have stuck to the three-person system, if just like you could have it move a little bit faster.
So I would put Final Fantasy IX above 4.
I would
put it above 7.
Nope.
And this is just my personal opinion.
Okay, fair.
Because I think that it is more mature than those two games.
Let's see, 4, I can understand where you're coming from. 7, I still feel like it really could benefit from a better translation, and then maybe the story would come out feeling a little more cohesive, complete, thorough.
I think with Final Fantasy IX, I mean, it's all a matter of taste, right?
Yeah.
I like the maturity of the writing, I think, mm-hmm. I was already saying this. Square was hitting it on all cylinders at this point. They had the technology. They put this thing together so fast. They knew what they were doing, but it's such a big game.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just following along as you experience Final Fantasy IX for the first time, there was so much I had forgotten about this game.
Yeah.
And I think I had a much greater appreciation mm-hmm. for everything that it accomplished. But more to the point, when this game first came out, American fans had a much different perspective on the series than Japanese fans.
That's true.
Because, I mean, I really got my start on the series with 7.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed 6, but 7 was where I fell completely in love.
Right.
And so many people were like that as well.
Exactly.
So I hadn't played the original Final Fantasy at that point.
Yeah.
So so much of the nostalgia and so many of the references mm-hmm. were totally lost on me. So now looking back on it all these years later, I can totally
point at everything.
Appreciate all of the callbacks and everything. Like at the time I was just like, well, what the heck is up with this final boss? What?
Oh yeah.
I thought I hated it.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm like, oh, that was pretty cool. Yeah. Okay. It's a total callback to the original Final Fantasy. Does it necessarily work in the context of the game?
Sometimes a little.
I
do feel like some of the continents were a little bit sparse. Once you leave the Mist continent and you have this whole world open to you, it's the overworld itself is a little bit empty, but that's just, it could just be like a symptom of RPGs back then.
So you seem a little lower on it and I seem a little higher on it.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think so. But I do very much appreciate it. I'm glad I played it. I know it's some people's mm-hmm. their absolute favorite. Like, I think Jim Sterling calls it, quote-unquote, his best one. But
I wouldn't go that far.
Yeah,
but I think it's...
Oh, my best one is still Final Fantasy VI.
All right, Nadia. Some people totally left comments on our final discussion about Final Fantasy IX and the conclusion. Johnny Boy 407 says, I'll stick up for the ending of Final Fantasy IX, mainly not killing off Zidane. I look at it this way. Garnet had all the summons forcibly removed from her body, found out that her entire race was executed, learned she was physically mutilated as an infant, had to watch her adopted mother die, and witnessed her citizens massacred by Bahamut. If the dude she kind of likes being alive gives her a little bit of happiness, I think she deserves it.
Okay, that's fair enough, definitely. Okay, I'll keep Zidane alive for Garnet. I will do it.
When you put it like that, you kind of realize that Garnet had kind of a crappy childhood, didn't she?
Just a bit. And actually, that's one thing I actually like about Final Fantasy IX, is it leaves you guessing in that regard. Like, her mother, her adoptive mother, you only see her when she's nasty, but apparently you hear that she was raised with care and love, and it's like, well, how true is that? They kind of cut your horn off, you know?
Telrain says, I like Final Fantasy IX a lot, but Necron's appearance is super lame. That said, it did lead to one of the sillier RPG stories I have, which I will now tell. Ooh, let's settle in, get some popcorn. Mm. I had finished Final Fantasy IX, loved the ending, still one of my favorites, and that night a bunch of friends were at my house doing this something that didn't involve the TV. I figured that I put the ending of Final Fantasy IX, put on the ending of IX, because I was young and stupid and thought people might care about an ending that was good because of the emotional investment of playing the game. My party was a bit underleveled and lacking in top-tier abilities, but I had a lot of auto-regen, which is seriously broken in FF9.
Mm-hmm.
I fought Necron for a bit until he ended up killing everyone in my party except Garnet, who was berserk in mini and just repeatedly attacking with some crappy racket for 3 damage. However, due to auto regen, Necron couldn't actually finish her off, so instead of resetting, I just kind of let the game run in the background, and my friends and I laughed about how silly it all was. Suddenly, Garnet tranced, which healed Berserk and Minnie, so I grabbed the controller, got the party back up, and resumed the fight, only to have everyone but Garnet die again.
Oh my god.
Except this time, she was not only Berserk, well, she was only Berserk, not Minnie, but she still seemed to be basically invulnerable, so I left her attacking for a few hundred damage at a time. I figured she tranced again eventually, but she actually ended up killing him with normal attacks.
Oh my god.
It was amazing, and I will never forget it.
So you basically killed a chaos god with a crappy ass like lacrosse stick that she uses. That's amazing.
I like how broken and crazy classic Final Fantasy games are.
They really are, aren't they? Not just 9, they're all kind of broken and to a ridiculous degree.
That was the best thing about the PlayStation Final Fantasy 9s was finding, and 6 to an extent as well, was figuring out how to break them over your knee.
Yeah, like 6, when I first played it, I was still very new at RPGs, so I didn't really know how to break them. But, of course, looking at the Let's Play thread, Let's Break Final Fantasy 6, is ridiculous. It's amazing. I love it.
Breaking Final Fantasy. Satellite of Love says, yeah, I've never wanted to play Final Fantasy 9 either. The battle speed problem is solved with the PC version, so that it helps at least a little.
Mm-hmm.
Except that you're just complaining about how slow it is the entire time.
Yeah, well, I think what he means is, like, you can stop the game, press the fast forward thing, and then, like, unpause it, and it gets the job done, don't get me wrong, but it is kind of tedious.
Lord Bob Bree says, officially, Necron is basically what you said it is, a callback to his Chaos / Ceramus. There's a theory that makes some sense that Necron is part of the Leafa tree that filters out souls. Also, Thousand Year Door is the best Mario, and I only wish Nintendo would return to what made it good instead of what it's been doing to the series lately. Just a small thing.
Yeah, like, I feel we'll have, like, a Paper Mario podcast someday, but,
Nah.
well, she has spoken, folks. I tried. Color Splash, I think, was really cute. I adored Paper Jam, but what it is I think Nintendo wants the Paper Mario games to be more action-based, which is fine, but Thousand Year Door was really special, and I would love to see it return to just like a pure RPG that's not Mario and Luigi.
So the theory about Necron and the Leafa Tree is that Necron was the spiritual form of the Leafa Tree that Garland talked about that blocks the souls in Gaia and all that.
Sure, why not? It works. Nothing saying he's not.
I just prefer that it's Chaos, and Chaos showed up and wanted to have some fun.
Hey, I'm Chaos. I'm bored. Let's do a thing.
Sketchlayer Josh says, the classic Final Fantasy end boss Gambit. It's never enough to fight the main antagonist. They have to be working for or merge with some kind of nebulous embodiment of evil nonsense. That's why Kefka is the best villain in the series. FF6 can tell an epic story with a large cast, but it never gets overwhelming because your goal of punch that clown remains consistent.
Yeah, that never quite changes, and I do love how Kefka, once he gains control of the world, he turns himself into a freaking god. Like, why not? He hates life, he hates everything, he may as well turn himself into a god.
Yeah, that's true. Final Fantasy VII confused me for the longest time because I was like, aha, Sephiroth is the villain. But what the heck is this Genova thing?
Yeah.
What? It came down from space? Huh?
And then he turns into like this one-winged angel, which at least Kefka, I understand, okay, he did it because he can and he's Kefka. Sephiroth, you never really get a good answer for why he turned himself into that thing.
Sephiroth isn't actually Sephiroth.
Oh, right. He's like...
The real Sephiroth is like dead.
Yeah. He's like a clone.
And this is a different Sephiroth or something. I don't know. But that's why he like totally turns into that.
I would say that this game is going to make more sense when the remake comes out, but it totally isn't.
Didn't he merge with Genova?
Possibly.
Somebody's going to explain this to me.
Someone in the comments, please straighten us out because we have no idea what's going on.
No, please don't. Soft spot for Final Fantasy V's X-Death, though. I'll harness the power of the void. I don't actually know what it is, but I'm going to harness it, I tell you. The big goof. I think Gilgamesh is the best villain.
Gilgamesh is a lot of fun, and I think he's in Dissidia 2, and some of his quotes are hilarious.
So that's the end of our Final Fantasy IX wrap-up. And, well, I mean, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And we would love to continue doing these reports. We're going to pick another game very soon to be able to continue. Maybe not the next episode, but the episode after that, I think. Well, we also play Monster Hunter. But, I mean, we're kind of open to suggestions, to be honest.
Yeah, you still need to finish the Mana Report, though.
Yeah, that thing. Right. Yeah. Oh, I mean, I kind of been distracted by Witcher 3. You know how it is with me.
Yes.
Like, I'll be like, yes, I'm totally going to play this game for a report.
But it's just so funny because I'm like, oh, this game is like my heart and my soul. And you're like, oh, right, that thing.
I finally finished Chrono Trigger.
You did. Well, Chrono Trigger is just other level, otherworldly. Like, it's just fantastic.
Yes, Chrono Trigger is definitely next level. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, yeah, Kunihiro really wants you to do Final Fantasy X.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we've already done a Final Fantasy, but, I mean, we could do more Final Fantasy.
Let's do Final Fantasy VII. Let's play it again for the 50th time.
Oh, my God. Let's talk about that for... God, I feel like we've talked about this game, Final Fantasy VII, more than, like, any other freaking RPG on this podcast.
We probably have. Let's do six, then.
I would love for somebody to go through all, like, 130 episodes and just look for the instances of the RPGs that we talk about the most. I bet it would be Final Fantasy VII.
It'd be up there, that's for sure.
Yes. But, yeah, give us suggestions. I mean, we can toss Witcher 3 in there. We can make... Nadia play it for the rest of her life. Persona 3?
Persona 3, I was thinking to myself, should I give that a play? Because I was writing out the games we want for 2018 or 19, and of course thinking about Persona 5, the Crimson, or something, whatever is inevitably going to come to the Switch. And I was thinking, you know what, I should really give 3 a try sometime. It looks kind of fun.
Well, you don't have a Vita.
Yes, I do. That's what I played.
Oh, right. You got a Vita for Golden.
I played Golden on that, yeah.
Yeah, you can totally get Persona 3 Portable on it.
Yeah, I might do that.
Yeah, there you go. So Persona 3, Witcher 3, Final Fantasy X.
Three.
Drop us a line. Do you have something else that you would totally recommend that we should be playing and talking about? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're open to a lot of different suggestions, within reason, of course.
New year,
and
new us.
We'll pick a different game in a couple weeks, but... Acts of the Blood God, US Gamer Podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are sold. Please subscribe to us, rate us, review us. We love hearing about what you think of the podcast. Mm-hmm. It keeps us going as we produce this week after week after week.
And as Kat struggles with the audio problems, it keeps her warm.
Yes. You can find me at @_Catbot. You can find Nadia at Nadia Oxford. And, of course, we stream every Tuesday and Thursday. We've been playing a lot of PUBG lately. But I also recently played some Darkest Dungeon. If you watched me, you would see that I had an extremely near-run battle with the Swine King.
Ooh.
Where, like, most of my party was down to almost nothing. And at least one of my characters was at death's door, which is, if they take one more hit, there's a chance that they will actually die.
Wow.
And so I was, like, really sweating that battle out, but I was able to just barely get through it without losing anybody.
Nice.
God. So,
good job.
Yeah, you should totally watch that. Because I was pretty confident going into that battle, and then you could see the confidence really starting to leave.
Slowly leaking out.
Yes.
In sweat.
In Darkest Dungeon, they say, overconfidence is slow but insidious killer.
Mm-hmm,
so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was me. So we'll be back next Friday, as always. Make sure to check out our other podcast, the US Gamer Podcast, which Nadia is also on, along with Katie and Mike, where they talk about what they played over the Christmas vacation and such, and their kind of predictions for the upcoming year. So yeah, subscribe to that one, too. All of the US Gamer Podcast goodness. But until then, I've been Kat Bailey, and for Nadia and myself, we'll see you again next week. And until then, happy adventuring.
Du willst beim Shoppen richtig Geld sparen? Dann lad dir jetzt die Idealo-App runter und finde aus tausenden von Shops den besten Preis für dein Wunschprodukt. Einfach und schnell.
Der Preis ist wow, und immer low, oh. Idealo, low, oh, low, oh. Idealo, low, low.
Jetzt downloaden und sparen. Idealo, die Preisvergleichs-App.